5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
When I had come down this hill, I had seen this creature cross the road. It would have ripped my locked door from my truck, extracted me from my vehicle, and there wouldn't have been a damn thing I could have done about it.
This thing, I got to notice in its eyes. Its eyes was real, real evil, real sinister looking. You know, the look it was giving me.
What are you reporting?
Jesus Christ, you better... Sheriff, see ya!
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Uh-oh.
Welcome to Sasquatch Chronicles, a place where people share their encounters. Let's start the show. Welcome to the show, everyone. Happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. I'm going to be down in the Dallas area towards the end of the month, beginning of next. I'm still lining out the dates. I'm working on a special project. See if we can't change the way television looks at this topic. But if you're down in those areas, you know, Oklahoma, surrounding areas, shoot me an email if you'd like to be on film. And you've had an encounter and you'd like to be on film to talk about it, shoot me an email, wes@sasquatchchronicles.com, along with your contact information. When I'm down there, I'll get in contact with you and see if we can't get you to be a part of the project. If you're down there, you haven't had an encounter and you want to go out, I'm sure I'll go out for a couple days out there with Bob and the boys down in East Texas, and you're welcome to come out with us. Shoot me an email if you're interested in that. I'd be happy to have you out there and go check out some areas. Go out with Tim Sermons. Come out with us. Hang out with us while we're down there. Again, if you had an encounter and you don't mind being on film, shoot me an email, wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. If you just want to come hang out for a couple nights, come hang out with us. Again, shoot me an email with your contact information. It's a special project that I'm working on. And I'm going to see if I can't shake up the television world with something a little bit more realistic on this topic. Kind of get rid of some of the nonsense that's on television now. I just flew back in from San Diego to do this show. And it's interesting, I was talking to a local resident there, and he'd asked me if I'd known anything about Zubies. And I thought, what the heck is a Zubie? And so while I'm down there, I start looking up Zubies, and the term Zubie is related to Sasquatch. And as I'm starting to research the area, and it's interesting, I actually drove out to the area where this happened back in the 70s. And it's a very interesting area. As you're driving along the highway, you look off to your left and off to your right, you'll see kind of rolling hills. You'll see large mountaintops. And it doesn't really seem like it's that dense a forest when you're out there. It seems kind of more like a high desert. But as I pulled off and drove through some of the areas, you start to realize really quick that not only is it very dense with pine trees and underbrush, that the story of the Proctorville monster is something that is very realistic and could have absolutely happened back in the 70s. The story starts back in the 70s in the Alpine area, and this is east of San Diego, and it's a police officer relating the story, talking about the gentleman that they had pulled over. Sergeant Doug Hoos of the San Diego County Sheriff's Department gave an interview in 1992. He said in the winter of 1971, they had pulled over Dr. Bedour, who was a prominent psychologist, medical doctor in the area. So they pull over Dr. Bedour, and in the front seat of his car, he had a loaded .44 Magnum revolver with a 6-inch barrel. The reason why the police officer remembered the specific gun is because at the time it was popular for Dirty Harry to carry the same gun. So the cops start talking to the doctor and they ask him, why do you have this gun up front? What's it for? Sergeant Hoos, who was off to the passenger side, thought he heard the doctor say, because of the Zubies. Now the police officer misheard what he said, but the term Zuby became coined among the police department to define these creatures, to explain these creatures. And this doctor had convinced these two officers of what was going on his property. He said he'd seen several creatures. He described their height. He described their behavior. Even invited them out to come and look at the property and see what was going on there for themselves. But it's kind of a long, involved story. It's a very interesting story. And if you go to SasquatchChronicles.com, you can read about it in the blog. It's a very, very interesting story. One of the things that caught my attention is one night the doctor said he was going to be late heading home. He called his wife and basically asked her to feed the chickens. So when she goes out to feed the chickens, you know, she says, "Here, chicky, chicky, chicky," as she's feeding the chickens. And then she had gone back in for the night, had fed the chickens. The doctor didn't return home until later that night. And when he returned home that night, he heard what he describes as a very deep, guttural voice saying, "Here, chicky, chicky, chicky," as he's getting out of the car. And it disturbed him enough. He had ended up calling the police. But if you get a chance, check it out. It's a very, very interesting story. And there's a detective from LA that actually came to investigate, that casted tracks, had pulled a bunch of evidence from the property to show that the doctor was actually telling the truth on what was going on. But it's a very interesting story. Again, it's under Proctorville Monster on SasquatchChronicles.com. If you get a chance, check it out. My first guest tonight, strange, I just got a text message from Mo. A lot of you might remember Mo from the Jurassic Park episodes. He's one of the gentlemen down there in Texas who was nice enough to take us out. And his text message, he's saying he ran into a Sasquatch at the hunter's camp. Oh, let's give him a call. It's my show. I can do whatever I want, right? Let's give Mo a call. Let's find out what's going on. And then we'll jump into the first guest. Let me, some happy music here while I dial him.
Hey, Wes, you there?
Yeah, what's going on, man? Yeah.
Yeah, I just made it in, man. I'm sitting in the easy chair right now in my man cave.
What happened? Well, let me ask you this. Do you mind if I record this and put it on the show?
Sure, go ahead.
So what happened, man? You were up at the hunter's camp, and what's going on?
Well, first I was down in a different area. I had a public speaking in Cleveland, Texas. And after the public speaking was over, I decided I got some daylight left. And I went to the one area where you had the log thrown at you.
Yeah.
And I went down there and I set up a recorder in pretty much that same area me and Bob were at. I didn't hear anything much, you know, a couple of things here, twigs and stuff, and, you know, could be deer. And earlier, Tim, me, Bob, and Travis went down to the real dangerous area. I thought it was going to be me and Travis. We went down to the dangerous area down there. We set up a mess load of trail cams, a whole bunch. So after that, I go to my public speaking, and I change into my, you know, my outdoors and clothes and I go to the area where you and Bob were at. Then from there, I drive to 100%. I pull in there. Of course, when I pull in there, I sit and I listen, look around, and smoke a cigar. And then I just decided I'm going to go up to the one area, up in that open area there, and I'm going to hang a recorder there. I also have some peanut brittle with me. It's the cube-style peanut brittle that you buy at Family Dollar. And what I did was I took a water bottle, and I cut a hole at the top, and I put like maybe 15 of those little peanut butter brittle cubes in there. I put it in my pocket, so I'm going to hang it in the tree. So as I'm walking to the area up the road there, I noticed that there are fresh, I'd say probably that day somebody had a horse out there. You could see it was pretty fresh. And alongside it were some pig tracks alongside of it. So I'm walking up, being cautious, careful. I finally get up to the area. I hang the recorder first. I go ahead and stamp my time on it. I say what time it is. And then I go and I hang the peanut brittle in the water bottle, hang it in a tree. Pretty high. And what I do is I hang it on the tree that I know if a coon goes up the tree or something goes up the tree will bend and it'll fall. The coon will fall. It'll bend the tree over. So I hang it about 7 feet in the air. As I'm doing that, I'm done. I walk to the back to the intersection, and I try out a new call. And what it is, I call it the crazy cat call. It's like, you ever hear a cute cat by your window?
Yeah, fire. Yeah.
You know how they get that real high-pitched squeal?
Right.
So I go out to the intersection, and I do this squeal, try it out, and it echoes like crazy. I turn my head to look back in the meadow area, and in a matter of 1 second, I see this large figure just, boom, go across the trail. And it was big. Now, it wasn't a deer, okay? I'm 90% certain that it was a squat, Wes. And it was very big and very, very wide. I'd say maybe 7.5 feet tall at most. And it was wide. Now, I did see a head. I saw an actual head on it. It's something that looked like shoulders and the head melted together, sort of. But here's the strange thing. When you interviewed me last time, I told you about the sighting I had with my kid. The one I saw was black. It was pitch black. You could see skin underneath it. Well, this took me by surprise because I wasn't expecting this color. And the best way I could describe it, I described it to Bob. I called him right after I saw it. And you ever seen a pine cone? The pine needles fall to the ground, branch, and to turn that color, that like lightish brown color. You ever seen that?
Yeah, kind of a light brown. Yeah.
Yeah, very, very light brown. Almost like, I don't know, like a golden retriever sort of color. That's what this color was. I didn't do a second take. I was just like, I just saw one that was really light, almost blondish. And I just couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, this is crazy, man. So I try to turn my camcorder on. It's on my tripod, and I carry it on my hip. And I was shaking so bad, Wes. It took me like, I couldn't get the record button on, man. I was shaking so bad. It took me like 3 seconds to get my hand steady to get the record button on. So I got the record button on finally. And, of course, there's nothing. And I'm like, dang. I sit there for like maybe 2 or 3 minutes, and I hear nothing. And I remember back to what Bob said to me about the lighter colored one. And this is what he told me. He said that they are very, very aggressive, very territorial, and they are mean as hell. When I thought about that, I said, you know what? I shut the camcorder off, and I just hooked it out of there and just walked back. On the walk back, I didn't hear anything, didn't see anything, but the walk was pretty, it was a pretty swift walk. I wanted to get back to my vehicle. Once I got back to the vehicle, that's when I called Bob. I mean, I'm going to tell you this. I think I saw one that was blondish in color or like a very, very, very light brown. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, they're up there. And he said, now you're by yourself. He says, I think the best thing, smartest thing to do is just leave. Get out of there. So I called Tim. And Tim says, oh, yeah. He says, yeah, you saw the one I saw. He said, it's like a light, very, very, very light color, almost golden, sort of, with a hint of, brown in it. And he says, you saw the one that I saw. I'm like, wow, unbelievable. And that was pretty much it. Tomorrow morning, I've got another public speaking at the same place in the morning, and I'm going to go pick up the reporters in both those areas, and hopefully I got something. It'll be about 12 to 13 hours of audio, and hopefully I got something. But that's it, Wes.
It's interesting.
I know what I saw.
When it ran across the trail, was it on four legs or was it on two?
It was on two. It was upright. It was tall. And I mean, I know people are going to say, "Mo, you know what you could have saw? You could have saw a whitetail jump, and they jump really high." And I know that. I mean, I hunted as a kid. I know that. But I'm telling you, this was not a deer. This thing was huge, man. It was wide and it was huge. I mean, I want to say it took up the whole path, but the path was about maybe 10 feet wide at most. And I'm going to say that it was, I mean, it had to have, I mean, looking at the head, it had to have at least 4 foot shoulders.
That's crazy.
The thing was.
It's interesting. I never really thought color meant anything. And I remember Bob telling me the same thing. He said there was one area he didn't want to take me into. And he said, they're really aggressive in that area. And I said, well, and he goes, yeah, they're kind of a lighter brown color. And you rarely ever hear them vocalized, but they're aggressive as hell in that area. And it's strange that they're kind of crossing over into that hunter's area.
And that's what I thought, man. I'm like, on the drive home, a million and one things racing through my head. Is there another plan that's up there? Because I know there was a big boy that he's nicknamed the big boy. He's been there for years, and I understand he is he's a darker colored one. And there's a clan of them up there that are darker colored. And that's what I'm expecting to see. I wasn't expecting to see this light colored one. I think maybe they're starting to cross paths, crossing paths here and there. Could he have been in the big boys area? I don't know. But all I know is when I turned and I saw that thing, I'm like, that is a damn squatch.
Yeah.
I'm not just going to sit here and say, man, it is definitely most assuredly a squatch, but I'm going to tell you what I saw. I saw something that had shoulders and a head, and it was very, very wide, and it crossed that path like a thousand one, boom, and that was it.
Well, you always wanted to see one cross the road, right? Now you got it, man.
No, exactly, man. Watch out what you wish for sometimes.
Yeah.
I got to tell you that after you see that, you automatically start to shake, man. I was just shaking. I mean, I felt like a kid on my first play in front of 150 people when I did my first play. I was nervous and shaking. I just, I couldn't even hit the button to my camcorder. I'm like, shit, what's wrong with me here, man?
Yeah, that's the thing that cracks me up. Sometimes people say, well, why didn't you get a picture if it ran across a trail? It's like, well, you go sit there, you have a thing run across a trail, and then you see if you can work the camera, get it up and hit record. Even if you've been out in situations, and I know you've been out in situations before where you ran into them, but even your hardened person that's seen them before still freaks out when they aren't expecting it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Wes, my heart was just beating out of my chest, man. I started to get a sweat, and I just started shaking, and then I just started looking all around me, because you also hear, hear things like, you see one, there's maybe a couple behind you. And that's another thing that started to race through my head. So I'm like, you know what? I'm getting the hell out of here. You know, I'm not going to be a statistic. So I got out of there and I didn't run. I just did a nice, you know, brisk walk back to the vehicle. Once I got back to my vehicle, I felt a little safe. You know, kicked back with some bottled water, smoked another cigar, and then that's when I called Bob. And he said, I think it's a good idea that you get out of there, Mo. And I always listen to Bob, you know. And here's the thing. When we went down to this one area, this real dangerous area, we really didn't hear a thing. Nothing. I mean, maybe you heard like a little tiny wail of sorts, but we didn't hear anything. So I considered it a pretty uneventful day. I wasn't expecting anything. And then all of a sudden I get this.
Yeah, it's always when you least expect it, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It really is, man.
Well, thanks, Mo. I appreciate you sharing the encounter. I appreciate you sending me the text. I was in the middle of an interview. I saw your text, and I thought, oh, man, I got to figure out, you know, because when I get a text from you or Tim or Bob, I like to drop what I'm doing and give you guys a call. So I really do appreciate you touching base. Let me know what's going on out there.
I mean, no problem, man. No problem whatsoever. And you know what? I just wish that you were there. I really wish you were there, Wes. You would have just been like, whoa.
Yeah,
Crazy, man.
Well, I'll be down there the end of the month, so, and I'll tell you about that later. But yeah, man, thank you again.
Okay, brother. Thanks for being there and you know, listening to me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mo. And I'll be in touch. My first guest tonight, a gentleman we'll call MT. He's from Washington State. He used to be a federal worker until he started talking about his encounter with some of his peers, and he was fired for talking about his encounter. But before we actually get to that main encounter when he saw the creature, I want to talk a little bit about some of the strange incidences that he's had while he's been out in the forest. But I want to welcome you to the show, MT.
Well, hey, thanks for having me on, Wes. I really appreciate it. I enjoy listening to you every night. That's what I do right before I go to sleep.
I appreciate that, man. You know, one of the things I wanted to get to before we actually jump into your encounter, will you talk a little bit about the Chief Aluska? And for people who don't know who Chief Aluska is, Mark and I are from the same area, and all the elementary schools would go out to Chief Aluska's. I remember it very vividly when I was, gosh, probably in third grade. And it's crazy when you and I were talking the other day, Mark, because I honestly didn't think about the ceremonial dance that I saw when I was a kid. I remember it terrified me. But do you want to talk a little bit about that, going out to Chief Aluska's and kind of what went on there? And
Yeah. Well, you know, as Wes said, we were from the same area, Vancouver, Washington. And we're right across the river from Portland, Oregon. You can see Mount Hood and Mount St. Helens in the distance. And every third grade class in Vancouver was learning about the Oregon Trail and the pioneers and Native Americans. At the end of the unit where you studied the Native Americans and the pioneers, they took the kids, busfuls of kids, to a field trip about 20 miles up the road, actually fairly close to where Wes and Woody had their sighting in Ariel, Washington. You know, you turn off the Woodland exit and you drive up to this little tiny community where there's a cedar longhouse, and Chief Aluska, I'm not sure if he was part of the Chehalis tribe or what tribe he was with, but, you know, he would have the kids come in. There would be wooden benches to sit on. They would dim the lights or be a fire going in the middle, kind of like a bonfire, and you'd hear the Native American drum playing, and Chief Aluska was in his traditional, you know, Indian gown. And he would have a microphone, and he would tell stories of the tribes and of his elders and the tribal legends. And part of the cool part was, you know, they would bring out Native American dancers who would be wearing these large wooden carved masks. And you would see, like, the head of a raven, and he would talk about Brother Raven. And you'd see, you know, different masks. And there was a hairy one. I remember he talked about Bukwas, which was the wild man of the woods. But he also ended up talking about Sinakwas, which would be Bukwas' wife, the woman, the wild woman of the woods. And one of the masks, I remember the male version actually had the whistling face with the pursed lips. But the female version, I remember the face opened up a couple times, and each time it opened, the face got scarier. And he talked about how this wild woman of the woods would carry a wicker basket on her back, and she would actually grab native children who were out past their bedtime and carry them off up into the mountains to eat them. And at this point in the dance, this person in the mask, this dancer, literally lunged over, reaching towards me. And I was maybe 8 years old, you know, we're talking third grade. Well, I thought this thing was going to pick me up and carry me off and over her shoulder and literally eat me. I was never so terrified in my entire life. I actually backpedaled over three benches full of kids, knocking the bench over, trying to get away from this dancer. The weird part was, it wasn't until I was in college that I realized that this was the Native American version of Sasquatch and Bigfoot. When I was in third grade, it was the same exact year that Roger Patterson and Mr. Gimlin's first name. But, Bob Gimlin, and they were down there and they caught the Patty film in California. It was the same fall that I went to Chief Waluska's. So I never really heard of Bigfoot, you know. We didn't see it in the movie theater or anything like that. But you were there, and it was pretty terrifying. And I sometimes think that because it reached for me, that it kind of marked me to have some kind of encounters off and on throughout my life.
Yeah, it's crazy. It was probably, and I've actually gone up there. I think Chief Waluska passed away. I think
he did.
Yeah, his son now runs it. And I remember that too. I remember the wild woman of the woods, and she lunged at me too. And it scared the crap out of me, man, because it was terrifying. You know, he's telling all of these, and it's weird because it never hit me at the time what they were actually talking about. He was talking about this wild woman and wild man of the woods that would eat people and to stay out of the woods. And it's just interesting that you brought that up. I wanted to jump in. Will you kind of give the audience, I was going to give one of my listeners a shout out because he always asks for a bio of the people who've had encounters. I don't have it right in front of me, but will you give the listeners kind of a quick biography of who you are?
Yeah, I am. You know, I grew up in the state, and I was really big into the Future Farmers of America when I was in high school, the FFA. I've always loved things that grow, you know, fish and wildlife and all that. And so, you know, I went to college to become an agriculture teacher, you know, future farmer advisor. And I taught school for 16 years. I taught FFA and farming and forestry management, natural resource conservation. I also ended up teaching biology and earth science to kids in junior high for about 8 years. So I taught a total of 16 years. After that, I ended up, I got divorced and my ex-wife moved to Eastern Washington. So I thought, well, I'm not going to teach over there, but I got to get a job related to farming. So I ended up managing a conservation district over in Walla Walla. And so that got me into doing fish and wildlife type work. I worked as a grant writer, watershed restoration coordinator for a watershed down in California. Then I got asked to come back to Vancouver area because there's 14 regional fish enhancement groups in Washington state that raise money for steelhead and salmon habitat restoration. And so I was a project manager walking on rivers, you know, for three counties in Southwest Washington. And I also ended up getting offered an executive director job for a while, with one of these regional fish enhancement groups. It's kind of interesting. I've written grant proposals to raise, you know, almost $1.7 million for fish and wildlife restoration. And at a Christmas fundraiser, when I was an executive director, I made the mistake of publicly saying out loud that I knew Bigfoot existed because I'd seen one from, you know, 8 to 10 feet away from me at Mount Rainier. And within 2 weeks, I lost my job. I was given no reason why I lost my job. They said they didn't need to go into it. And I went from making over $52,000 a year to zero overnight. And I was unemployed for 5 years. I applied for over 500 jobs. In a six-year period, I drove to interviews in Oregon, Idaho, Washington, and California, and I couldn't find a job in fish and wildlife, to save my life. And believe it or not, I now work parking cars for a living. And, that's why I kind of keep my name private, is because I still apply for fish and wildlife jobs. I love doing that. I'm good at it. So that's kind of my background. I used to jokingly say, well, you know, when I was a kid, we were trailer trash, but we were actually too poor to afford a trailer. So So I do have a brain, you know, when I had my encounter, I know exactly what I saw. You know, I've worked out on the streams and the rivers and in the forests, and, you know, a lot of people argue with me about what I saw over the years, and I don't talk to them anymore. That's kind of where I came from, you know, teaching fish and wildlife stuff and raising money for that kind of stuff.
And when did you start noticing there was weird things going on in the forest? What's kind of the first couple incidences?
Well, you and I kind of grew up in a different era. You know, we didn't lock our front doors at night. We'd go to church in our house. We didn't lock our doors when we were gone. And, you know, in the summertime, your mom would kick you out of the house. You know, we had five kids. And so you guys go outside and play, get some fresh air. My mom would always say, get some fresh air and get the stink off of you. And so we actually lived at the end of a paved road that was right next to a lettuce field. And it's really sad in Vancouver when you drive along Burton Road, there's all these houses and apartment complexes and parking lots. The entire valley used to be lettuce field from one end to the other, except for a small housing complex where I lived. And so, you know, we'd go down to the end of the street, and we would actually, there was a big pasture with what we called the killer donkeys, because if you tried to sneak past the donkeys of the creek, they'd actually chase you and try to bite you on the shoulders. And we'd get down to Burnt Bridge Creek, and we'd go crawdadding, and we'd go trying to catch trout. The biggest thing we ever caught was 6 inches, so we always let them go. And we'd go skinny dipping, you know, no girls around. And I was by myself one day, and I went across the creek, and I decided to see what was up on the hill, because my brothers told me there was a forest up there. And up at the top of the hill, under the power lines, and I guess a lot of people have seen stuff along power lines, there was a thin strip of a lettuce patch that, you know, I don't know, it's maybe 100 feet across and then, you know, all the way down the road. And on the other side of the lettuce, there was a forested plot. Well, as I was walking along this summer road, you know, in my tennis shoes and my, you know, t-shirt and tank top, I noticed that they had been irrigating the lettuce, and that they must have did it early in the day because the ground was dry again. But near the pipe where the irrigation pipe came out of the ground, the pipe had been leaking and squirting water in one spot, so it made a mud slick. And if you've ever been to this part of the state, there's a lot of clay in the soil, so when the mud dries down, it's really, really a slick, slippery spot. And I walked up to it, and I saw this gigantic footprint. Well, I'd never heard about Bigfoot. I was about 12 years old at the time. And I'd never seen the Patterson-Gimlin film. But I thought, wow, that's really cool. You know, there's this gigantic footprint that was about 18, 19 feet long, or not feet, inches, you know. And I thought, how in the world did somebody do that? And I thought, first of all, why would they do that? I started looking around because, you know, back then it was Portland Trailblazers, and even one of those guys, I don't think their foot would have been quite this long. So I just thought I was going to mimic this footprint in the mud and figure out how they did it. So I took one sock and one shoe off. And I put my foot down, and my foot was just miniature compared to this gigantic track. So I decided to put my heel down, and I lifted up my toes, and I slid them all the way forward, slid my heel, and pressed my toes down even with the toes next to the track. And I made this long, skinny, funny-looking track that had a heel mark at the back, and it also had a heel mark in the middle because I, you know, slid my foot forward. And I couldn't figure out how this person did it. And then all of a sudden I had this really weird feeling, and the hair on the back of my neck and the hair on my arms stood up, and I felt like something was watching me, and it felt dangerous. And I kind of sat up and I looked around, and I didn't see anybody. So I got real nervous though. So I shoved my sock into my pocket of my shorts because, you know, my foot was all muddy, and I crammed my foot back into my tennis shoe, and I started walking towards down this dirt road, looking from side to side. And the dirt road ended in another road that went down the hill straight to the next street over that was paved. And there was a forested strip along the right side of the dirt road with the lettuce field on the left. And the strip was, they had cleared the opposite side of this forested strip of trees. And you could see another pasture through the trees. You could see sunlight. And as I was walking down the hill, you know, going towards home, thinking like somebody was following me, I heard a branch snap to my right, and I stopped, and I looked over, and I swore I saw a giant shadow step behind the tree. And I thought, okay, this is weird. You know, and back in those days, they didn't have a lot of TV channels, and they weren't talking about, you know, pedophiles and all that stuff, or kids getting kidnapped. But I just had a feeling that somebody was watching me from behind the tree, so I quickened the pace and went down the hill. And, you know, I heard the snap again, and every time I look over, I swear I saw a shadow behind the tree. So I took off running for home, you know, and I finally got home. The weird thing is, when I got home, I never told anybody about it. I was just, you know, 12 years old, you get your mind on something else. But then when I was in college, I used to go grousing at the Larch Mountain, and I always had the weird feeling when I was carrying my 12-gauge shotgun that whenever I'd walk down this one dirt road to get to my grouse hunting spot, I'd have to go under a huge canopy of maple trees. So it was kind of dark and shadowy, even though the sun was out. And I always had a feeling someone's going to jump on me from up in the limb. So I'd always watch up above me, you know, and I'd see squirrels and all that. And I went grouse hunting for years, and I was on my motorcycle. I'd strap my 12-gauge shotgun to my side of my bike, believe it or not, with bungee cords. But one day when I got up there, something was different. And as I came around this curve in the dirt road, this old cat road, all of a sudden I got hit with the most powerful stench you've ever smelled. I mean, it was so strong it made me want to gag and throw up. And the only way to describe it, and I got to tell you, right before the stench hit me, the hair on the arms and the neck stood up again. And I got hit with this, just assaulted with this awful stench. And it smelled kind of like a wet dog with garbage, and it smelled like rotting flesh. And if you've ever been on a farm, my grandpa's a dairy farmer, and I actually, as a kid, I found a dead bloated cow that was rotting away with maggots from the flies, and that's about what it smelled like. And so I whipped my shotgun pointing up the hill towards the smell, and then all of a sudden I realized, I thought, oh, my God, what if this is a black bear? And I got a single-shot shotgun with birdshot in it, and if I pull the trigger, I'm just going to piss something off. You know, it'd be like getting peppered with rock salt or something. So I actually popped open the shotgun. The shell shot over my shoulder, and I grabbed a deer slug out of my vest and slammed it in and shut the gun, and I pointed it uphill. And I was shaking like a leaf because I thought I'm about to get mauled by a bear. You know, maybe I'm between a sow bear and her cubs. And speaking of potential cubs, all of a sudden I heard the branches move below me on the other side of the dirt road. There was a ravine, and I heard something down in the ravine, and it snapped a branch. And I thought, oh, crap, I am between a female bear and her cubs. And so I went and looked down in the ravine for a second, and then all of a sudden up on the side of the hill, all hell broke loose. And I turned around and whipped my gun uphill just in time to see a rotten log come rolling down the hill at me. And the thing was probably 24 to 36 inches around. It was a bit like a big old cedar log or Doug fir log. And it came bouncing and rolling down the hill. I jumped about 3 feet to the side. It went flying over the dirt road and down, crashing into the ravine. So normally, you know, naturally you turn and watch the log as it's going past and down the ravine. So I looked down the ravine. And when I did, all of a sudden, like I said, all hell broke loose up on the hill again. And something, I don't know what it was, but it was big. It went busting through the brush, running, you know, across the side of that hill. And whatever it was escaping from me. Well, you know, I'm sitting there with a single shotgun, and I'm thinking, I got to get the hell out of here, because I knew that bears can't roll logs at people, and I knew that, you know, deer and elk don't do that kind of thing. And the only thing I thought of, and at that age, I knew about Bigfoot, and I thought, oh, crap. This is not a good thing. So I thought, I got to walk back up this cat road to my bike. And the scary part was that this thing ran across the hill, and it actually went right across the dirt road that I had to go back up to my bike. So the whole way up, my heart's pounding. I'm racing up this hill. It usually took about 20 minutes or 25 minutes to go walk down this hill to get to where I was. And it probably took me 10 minutes to get back to my motorcycle. I was moving that fast, you know, just hauling ass. And I was so nervous, I strapped that shotgun on the side of the bike with the bungee cords, you know, making sure it was unloaded, of course. And I had a Honda Hawk 400. It was the first motorcycle Honda made with mag wheels, and it actually was the first bike they had that redlined at 12,000 RPM. And I started that bike up, and I actually revved it, and I brought that street bike with the handlebars right up to my chin. You know, I kind of spun gravel, and I rode a wheelie for about 10 feet, brought it down, and you know, I went home. The weird thing is, when I got home, I didn't tell anybody about it. And the next weekend, when I had time off from college, I decided to go back up there. And, you know, I normally don't tell this story because I think people would think I'm nuts. But I came back up, and I had a bright orange-red motorcycle. And, you know, it's a pretty unique-looking bike. It was really nice-looking, pinstriping on the sides of the tank. And, you know, you could recognize me from a block or two away, like, oh, here comes Mark, because you'd see that red-orange tank. And I went back to go grouse hunting, and I noticed a guy building a log house off to the right side of the pasture, and I love log homes, and so I turned to look. And when I turned back, suddenly there was this rock came off from the left side of the road. It was a little bit bigger than a grapefruit, you know, really big-sized grapefruit. And it kind of did one or two little bounces, and it stopped on the gravel road right in front of my front wheel. Well, I'm doing 40 miles an hour, and you know, when you're a bike rider, I think you rode bikes, you're constantly looking about 40 to 50 yards in front of you to make sure you don't hit stuff and, you know, watch out for dogs. And I didn't have time to react to this rock. And I was sure it came flying from the left side of the road, which is basically where they constructed the road. They cut into the side of the hill, and you can see the reddish-brown clay soil with grass and trees up on top of the cut bank. And my bike hit the front wheel of my bike hit that rock, and it started to vibrate up the forks of the bike. And the whole bike, remember the handlebars and the throttle and the brakes were vibrating under my fingers. And the bike started to vibrate, and it started, the back wheel started to vibrate and turn around. It was like I was hydroplaning on top of gravel. I thought, well, I'm going to have to lay this sucker down. And so I started to lay the bike down. And when I did, the foot peg, the rubber foot peg caught, and it catapulted the bike. And I flew about 70 feet through the air. I remember just having time to say, oh, dear God, please save me, because I thought when I came down, I was going to get my head ripped right off because I was upside down. And I always tell people God had a wicked sense of humor. I got pitched into a 12-foot blackberry bush right in the middle. Saved my life. Took two guys 20 minutes to find me and cut me out of the brush.
Oh, Jesus.
I fractured three ribs. The motorcycle was still going. You know, it tumbled end over end, and it ripped off the mirrors, ripped off the foot pegs, ripped off the turn signals, bent the sissy. I had a short a two-tier touring seat, with diamond tuck leather seat with a little sissy bar on the back, you know, on the what you call the bitch seat part. And that got bent forward, and the handlebars were bent at a 45-degree angle. And the guy building the log home, he saw my bike tumbling in over end, and he flagged down a Jeep so they could look for me. And the weird part was I couldn't feel nothing. I was yelling for help. I had a full face shield down, so it was reflecting back in my ears. And finally, the guys found me, and I remember seeing two faces looking over me as I'm looking at the blue sky and clouds. And they flipped up the face mask, and they said, are you okay? And, well, the weird thing was I couldn't feel anything from the hips down. I had no feeling in my legs. And I said, yeah, I'm okay. Stand me up. And, you know, I damaged my spinal cord. I didn't realize it. But they stood me up, and all of a sudden the feeling came back. Believe it or not, I rode that mangled bike about 20 miles back home to a girlfriend's house. And she ended up taking me to the hospital. But, you know, I tell people, you know, I walk with a limp because of Bigfoot. I don't tell the story very often. But then I heard one of your episodes. You were talking about a guy riding an ATV, you know, four-wheeler, and a big rock came past his head. So I thought maybe it wasn't crazy after all. You know, I remember going back and seeing that rock, and it was dry on the top, and it looked like it had been pulled out of like, brownish-red clay soil. And so I was pretty sure it came at me from the left side. And I was kind of wondering down the road if maybe whatever had rolled the log at me recognized the color of my gas tank and decided to get a little bit of revenge for, you know, hunting in their area. And so, you know, so I've had these encounters. My first year teaching, I taught in Oakville, Washington, and I taught logging kids, you know, kids of loggers and Native Americans, the Chehalis tribes up there. And my boys in my class, you know, teaching forestry and agriculture, they decided they wanted to have a fishing tournament that year, you know. And we were keeping track of who was catching salmon and steelhead and how big they were and how much they weighed. And I was on the Chehalis River, you know, about a mile from my house. I lived out near Capitol Forest. And it was getting dark, and, you know, it was against a lot of fish after dark, you know, back in those days. So I'm starting to reel in my reel. And I'm packing up all my gear, closing up my tackle box, and all of a sudden something across this field from the road, from the old river ramp, you know, the old boat ramp, something busted loose and just went running down the opposite end of this pasture. And I thought, Jesus, I said, oh, I must have scared a big old bull elk, because there's a lot of elk around there and they're pretty big. And, you know, I've heard that sound before, you know, something taking off, busting through the brush. And so I thought, oh, I must have scared an elk. And then as I got my tackle clothes and I started to walk around to the back of my car, all of a sudden this thing came running back in the dark, and it sounded pretty heavy, and it actually sounded like it was on two legs, so that was kind of confusing to me. And so I kind of backed around to the front of my car where the headlights were on, because it was pitch black out, and I thought that was weird. I'd never seen the elk come running back. So I started to walk towards the trunk of my car again, and all of a sudden here comes this heavy stomping noise, comes flying back towards my car, ran past to the opposite end of the field. And I'm thinking, okay, I scared a horse, you know, some kind of domestic livestock, a horse or a cow or a big bull or something. And it did it about four or five times. And finally, when I was at the far end of this pasture, I just threw all the crap in the door of my car and I drove home. And the next day at school, the kids were saying, hey, did you catch any fish? Because they're all writing their fish up on the chalkboard, you know, who caught what. And I go, no, but I had the weirdest experience. And I told them about the heavy stomping, you know, down there along the Chehalis River near the boat ramp. But I didn't tell them where I was fishing because, you know, you didn't want to share your fishing holes with the other guys in case you caught a big fish. So all of a sudden, this one kid in the class, he was a Native American part of the Chehalis tribe. And the kid was a Golden Gloves boxer. He was not afraid of anybody. He looked at me and he said, you were fishing down by the boat ramp, weren't you? And I says, yeah. I go, how'd you know? Was that you last night? And he says, no. He says, we don't fish there this time of year, Mr. Taylor. And he looked at the ground. He looked at the floor and wouldn't make eye contact. And I says, well, why not? He goes, that's his spot. And he looked at the floor again. He wouldn't make eye contact. He was acting real nervous and weird for this kid because he had a really strong personality. I've never seen him act like this. And I said, him who? I said, it's not private property, I said. He says, yeah, he says, it belongs to somebody, and he wouldn't tell me who, and his girlfriend finally punched him in the arm. She said, tell him so he doesn't get hurt. So I said, John, what's going on? He looked at me, and he says, Bigfoot. And I said, what? And now there's, you know, a lot of farmy boys and logging boys in that community, so they started making fun of John. Whoops, I gave his name. Sorry. And I won't tell you his last name, but they were pitching him crap because he was talking about Bigfoot. They thought that was crazy. Well, he was from the Chehalis tribe, and he said, no, he says, these things come through the migrate through the reservation this time of year. And he says, we don't go outside after dark, and we don't go fishing there because that's his spot, and we respect them. And he says, he finally looks me in the eyes. He says, whatever you do, if you ever see one at night, and he says, don't look it in the eyes, Mr. T. He says, don't look it in the eyes or they'll steal your soul. And so those were my kind of encounters that I had. I never saw anything, you know, all three times, the footprint, the log roll, the heavy stomping, all three times the hair on my neck and my arms stood up. The weird part is, you know, I bought a book years ago called the Bigfoot Case Book, and they had all these cases of Bigfoot listed in the United States, and some of them were a few pages long, and some were just these little one-sentence blurbs that they recorded it. And I noticed that Oakville, Washington actually had a couple of sightings like decades before. There was a gal named Callie Lund, I think like in 1932 or 42, who was walking home from a high school dance on the snow, and one of these big hairy ape-like creatures beckoned to her with his arms out. It was trying to get her to come to it. And she ran off screaming, and her mom told her a story of when she first got married. Her husband was a potato farmer, and he drove their crop of potatoes to Aberdeen, Washington, and in the early 1900s, and when he was gone, this big ape-like creature was actually walking down on the porch around their house. And so Oakville actually has a history of sightings. It's right near the Capitol Forest. Years later, I'd stop by to go fishing because there's great sea-run cutthroat fishing there on the Chehalis and the Little Cribs. And one of my old landlords told me, when I told him about my Bigfoot experience, he laughed. He said, oh, he's in my gold such and such. And he told me that one of his buddies had found a footprint right along the edge of the riverbank. And I said, really, where was that? And he said, oh, down by the old boat ramp, he said. And so, you know, that kind of, for me, that justified what I had heard was probably a Sasquatch. You know, I didn't see it, but, you know, the kids were telling me to be careful.
Well, yeah, and up until this point, you really haven't seen anything, but you've had these strange encounters. You've heard strange things. You've had things thrown at you. But there was a time where you did see something. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah, you know, and I was married and I had my first baby, and my ex-wife now was pregnant with our second kid. And, you know, her mom and her grandfather owned 10 acres about 2 miles west of the Mount Rainier National Park on the West Gate, up in a little community called Ashford. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that Washington State's had more recorded Bigfoot sightings than any other place on the planet. And I just happen to live in Pierce County, Washington, where if you go to the BFRO site, they say that Pierce County has more sightings than anywhere in the state. And so, you know, I taught sixth grade in Eatonville, Washington, or was getting ready to start the teaching year. My ex-wife liked me to go up to her grandfather's wooded lot. He had 10 acres and cut firewood for him because he was probably 80 years old, and he had a wood stove and heated his home with wood. So I spent the whole summer cutting about 6 cords of firewood, splitting and stacking. And we decided to go up there for the 4th of July. You know, being a teacher, I had the summer off, and I took my wife and my daughter up there, and we actually had a barbecue, and then there was this restaurant in a touristy area that actually had a fireworks display every year, so we drove to that. Then we went back home for dessert to the place, and, you know, I had to teach, we were going to go home the next night, not spend the night, and it's 26 miles from Ashford to Eatonville, Washington, and it's a long 2-lane forested highway, and it's really dark at night. Back in those years, there was only like 2 or 3 street lamps in 26 miles. And as we're driving home, I saw these street lamps that were maybe 150 yards away, and I knew that they were at the entrance of the Mount Rainier National Headquarters, which actually isn't in the park. It's a couple miles outside the park. And I saw somebody crossing the road, and they kind of looked like a pedestrian crossing sign, you know, the big yellow diamonds with the black stick person with the round head. I thought, geez, that guy's got a big head, because it looked big and round, just like the stick person on the sign. And so I asked my ex-wife, I said, is that a guy or a girl crossing the road? Well, she was reading a quilting magazine with a flashlight and ignoring me, and we actually weren't getting along that well in our marriage at that point, so she tended to ignore me. And we kept getting closer, and I kept saying, is that a man or a woman? And, you know, I should have realized that 150 yards, I shouldn't have been able to see somebody that far away, look that big. And I recall the person actually crossing a 2-lane highway in about 5 steps. And then they stepped off onto the grass, and well, then I didn't really see them anymore. They kind of blended in with the trees at that distance. And as we got closer, I probably got about, I don't know, 30, 40 yards away, if that. And I saw this gigantic person standing on the side of the road on the grass right next to the trees. Well, I didn't realize they were gigantic until, you know, and it was a silhouette. You couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman. And the week before, we'd actually almost hit a woman who stepped out of the trees out in the dark, and she was drunk. She got kicked out of the truck by her boyfriend, and we had to drive her home. So I thought, oh, it's that gal again. But I saw the silhouetted person, and they reached up a hand, perfectly shaped hand, 4 fingers and a thumb, and it was the size of like a pizza pan from Papa Murphy's, a large pizza. And right then and there, my brain perked up. And I remember saying, why is that dude wearing a fur coat in July? And then all of a sudden, when they lifted the hand up to push this conifer brow in front of its face, like a hemlock bough, the light from behind it bounced off the arm and it lit up the left side of the head. And I saw an ear. And it looked human, but it was dark. And it was in the wrong spot on the side of the head for a human, because the head was big and bulky looking. And all of a sudden I realized that the ear was totally surrounded by hair. It looked exactly like a lowland silverback gorilla, like a big male gorilla, with the way their ears are, with the fuzzy ear, hair growing all the way around them. And my brain said, that ain't human. And I just slammed on my brakes at, you know, 55, 60 miles an hour, just locked them up in my car. And I don't remember if I did a 360 or not. I remember losing sight of the darn thing. But, you know, I remember seeing this thing when it reached up. You could see the bicep move under the hair. It bulged. The shoulder on this thing was as big as my butt cheek. The bicep was as big as my upper thigh on my leg. And as we slid past it, you know, when it came back into sight, I realized I was only about 8 to 12 feet away from this thing. I actually had to look up to see its butt cheeks when I was sitting in my car. I had a little Dodge Colt and a little four banger. And as we slid past, I realized it had really well-developed butt cheeks. It had a really broad back. The shoulders were a minimum of 4 feet across. And the most bizarre thing that I saw was this huge, rounded hump of muscle on top of the shoulders. and it was so big, the dome-shaped muscle, that you could not see the head from behind it. And I remember we slid past it. I couldn't see it anymore, and the car died. The car stalled. And we're sitting there out in the dark highway, and we slid past where the lights were, so we're in the dark again. And our lights are kind of, you know, pointing out towards the trees, because I actually cranked my car sideways to the left at 60 miles an hour, so I could put my headlights on it. And I'm shaking like a leaf, and I'm saying, oh, my God, oh, my God. And I remember realizing that Jesus Christ had a middle name that night, and it started with the letter F. I mean, it just kind of flew out of my mouth.
Yeah.
And then I'm feeling bad because I grew up in church, so I don't talk that way.
Right.
I kept saying, oh, my God, Jesus Christ, do you know what I just saw? And my ex-wife is just hysterical, screaming, start the car. You know, and I was so exhilarated, pumped full of excitement and adrenaline that I saw one of these things that I didn't even think to be scared. My ex-wife, she was scared enough for both of us, you know. And the weird thing was, if she wouldn't have been with me, I probably would have backed up the car and turned around to get the headlights on it. And in fact, I was thinking about it, and she looked at me, she said, start the car overall, and I said, what, you'll walk home? And I reached across and opened their door. She'd been always saying, do this or I'll divorce you kind of crap, and I got tired of hearing it. And, you know, I feel bad nowadays that, you know, I scared the crap out of her like that. But we took off and we went back home, and I said, I'm going back the next day, because I knew right where it was, because there's only three sets of headlights and 20, or street lamps in 26 miles. So the next day, her sister came with us, my 16-year-old sister-in-law. She came with us. We drove all the way back there. And I found the spot where it pushed a tree branch out of his face. And I got out of the car, and I jumped, and I jumped, and I tried to touch this tree branch. And no matter how hard I jumped, I was pretty athletic. I coached four sports back then. I could always come about an inch or two from a basketball hoop from the rim from touching it. I could hit the net, but I couldn't ever touch the hoop of the basketball. So I thought, man, this thing's got to be 10 feet tall. So I got in my trunk, and I always carry a fishing rod back there, and I had my regular, you know, trout fishing rod, and I had a 12-foot fishing rod for sturgeon and salmon. So I got out the 12-footer, and I put it together, and I got out my tape measure, and we looked at where I put it on the ground right next to the tree, the bough, and I held it up, and we saw where it was touching the fishing pole, and we laid it back down, and we measured it. And I tell people it was 10 at the chin, and by that I mean 10 feet at the jawline. And the head on this thing was over 10 inches tall, or 12 inches tall. It was enormous. So, you know, 10 plus 1, that's 11 feet. And I'm thinking, okay, that can't be right. You know, I'm crazy. Nothing is 11 feet tall. It looks like a gigantic person. And, you know, I flashed them back to the night before. And the thing, it was not black. It was not white. It was under one of those big vapor lights. I think it was like a light brownish color, kind of like a grizzly bear. You know, because if it would have been black or white, I would have been able to tell. And, you know, I just remember the thing. It was so muscular and so perfect. You know, and everybody always talks about how they see the ones, their arms are like down to their knees. It wasn't like that. If you've ever seen the movie Prometheus with the gigantic aliens, or you've seen movies with Olympic gods in them, you know, it was like that. It was a gigantic, perfectly shaped human, except for the hump of muscles on the back of the neck. And the head was wrong. And it looked like an Olympic athlete crossed with a giant, crossed with a big silverback gorilla, except for it didn't have a big beer belly. The belly was flat. And it had a big, broad chest. I remember a huge barrel chest on the thing. And so, you know, we put the fishing rod away because, okay, this thing's 11 feet tall. I'm thinking, oh, it's got to be heavy. And, you know, I used to be an agriculture teacher, and I used to show cows in the show rings at the state fair and stuff. You know, so I've actually been picked up off the ground by a big black Angus bull when I was holding onto a harness and lifted off the ground and walked across an arena before trying to stop this damn bull, you know. And so I'm pretty good at judging weight on animals, and this thing weighed 1,000 pounds to 1,100 pounds minimum if it was an ounce. I mean, it was nothing but muscle. And so we put away the fishing rod. We decided to go look for footprints because it's got to be pretty heavy. Well, I got under the trees, and it was, you know, the forested meridian on the sides of the highway that they leave, so it looks nice in Washington State. And the trees were so close together that they were like second growth trees. They weren't totally mature, and the sunlight was blocked out, so there was a layer of dead yellow needles on the ground under the trees. So, you know, being July, the ground's rock hard. There's no impressions. But the thing drug its heel. Every time it took a step, it would drag its heel, and it would scuff the needles out of the way all the way down to bare dirt. And there was a line of scuff marks. They were 5 inches across, and they were about 5 feet apart. And I would try to jump to the next one, and I couldn't even get that far. You know, it was just way too far to try to stretch your legs and to jump. And so my sister-in-law and I were following these scuff marks through the deep needle down to the earth. And then we got in the parts of the forest where the tree branches started slapping me in the face because it was getting really thick and dense. And there was a couple spots I had to crawl on my belly commando style to follow these scuff marks because the trees were down, the limbs were down to my knees. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this thing plowed right through this at midnight. And I was thinking the whole night long, thinking, okay, maybe it was a guy in a monkey suit or something like that. But when I got there and I was seeing how tall it was, and I couldn't even touch the branch, and that it had just plowed through really dense layers of tree limbs, I think, oh, my God, this thing had to be real. And we followed these scuff marks for over 100 yards under the trees. The trees finally cleared out. There was a big flat mud spot, or earthen spot, where they had taken the earth mover and they'd flattened it out, and then they actually rolled it with big, you know, steam rollers to flatten it out. And that's where they stored the gravel, and that's where they stored the snow plows for the winter. And so I lost track of the scuff marks. I thought, crap, we lost it. So then I thought, I wonder if I lay on my belly if I can still see these things. And so I got down on the dirt, and I laid down, and I looked with my head sideways, and damned if I couldn't see the scuff marks again. They were still there about 5 inches across and about 5 feet apart. So I told my sister-in-law, run across that to the other side of the dirt. And I said, I'm going to tell you right where the tracks are so that way we can pick up the trail. And she went across, and she was probably a good 30 yards away from me. And I said, okay, I said, move to the left, move to the left, move to the left. No, one step back to the right. I said, right there, that's where the trail is. I said, do you see anything beyond the dirt? And she started screaming, oh, my God, you got to come see this. So I stood up, and I ran across, and here were these deep heel impressions in the grass. Something walked over the hill on two legs, and there were heel marks that were about 5 inches across, nice and round, and they were so heavy they pushed down through the grass into the dirt. And it went down a straight line at the bottom of the hill. There was this really dark sand of timber. And it was broad daylight and sunny out, but it was so dark down there it almost looked like night. And I looked at my sister-in-law, she looked at me, and we both said, "That ain't." We ain't going down there. And I said, no way. I said, even if I had a rifle, there's no way I would go down there. So, you know, all these years later, it's like 29 years later, and I kicked myself because I found out just beyond those trees was a creek, and every spring it overflowed and left a nice layer of silty mud on both sides. Just past that was a sandbar and then the Squally River. If I would have followed the tracks, I would have actually probably found full footprints to cast. I should have cast the heels, but back then, you know, 30 years ago almost, nobody was talking about dermal ridges. I thought, well, people are going to think I'm stupid if I cast heel prints. I mean, that would be dumb. Plus, I was kind of unnerved, you know, when you realize how big this thing is. We didn't want to hang around any longer. We both got really, we weren't feeling too great, so... So we got back in the car and we left, you know. And so that's kind of my encounter, you know. I mean, the thing was standing under big vapor light on the highway. I got an awesome view of it. I never saw the face. That's what's always killed me for 3 decades, is I want to know what the face looks like on these things. Never saw the feet because it was standing in 6 inches of grass at the time. But, you know, I saw the body, and it was like a gigantic hair-covered giant man. I mean, looked like a big athlete. And it didn't appear to have ape-like proportions except for, you know, the broad shoulders and the muscle hump on the back of the neck and the way the ear looked with the hair surrounded. I've had people tell me I'm crazy over the years. You know, I said, I don't care. I said, I may never convince you they exist, but I said, there is no freaking way on this planet that you will ever convince me that they don't exist, because I said I was less than 10 feet away from it.
It's interesting that you're able to go back and actually get, you know, see the tracks and somewhat get the evidence that, yes, in fact, you weren't dreaming. Something did come across the highway and something was standing there. What did your ex-wife say about the encounter?
You know what? She wouldn't talk about it. And it's been my she was pregnant with my youngest daughter, who's turning, she's 28 and December. So it's been 27 years, and my ex-wife has never, ever talked about it. She won't talk to my daughters about it. When they bring it up, she just looks at them, shakes her head, and ignores them. You know, the weird thing was, the year before, her own brother had property up there. He was coming home from working in Puyallup. He worked for the school district down there, and he'd drive 45 miles every night. He actually almost hit one down by Eatonville with his pickup. And he was so unnerved when he got up there, he pulled into his grandfather's house. He doesn't drink, but he drank three beers. He was shaking like a leaf. He went back with his mom the next day, and they went to look for tracks, and there was about 20 people standing in the field, and they were all walking around looking through the grass, and nobody wanted to ask the other people what they were looking for, but they all had seen the same thing, you know, in this town. In fact, Pierce County, you know, Bram, Washington, near Puyallup, my ex-mother-in-law, they owned 10 acres down in Bram, which is a tiny little place with nothing but trees at the time. They had a property with a bunch of alder trees, saplings growing on it, and she told me the story about how they had a travel trailer, you know, a big camper-style trailer, and they were cutting trees on the property and clearing pasture land, so they wanted to put a triple-wide manufactured home in. And, you know, they'd been out cutting trees and stacking them and burning the slash pile, and the sun was going down, and she had made dinner, and she was standing in the travel trailer washing dishes while her father, you know, my ex-wife's grandfather, he was smoking a cigar, drinking a beer, and playing solitaire at the table, the kitchen table. And she heard a thump on two thumps on the side of the trailer. She looked up, and she said she saw a gigantic face, looked like a gigantic ape. The eyes were, you know, not quite the size of ping pong or tennis balls, but they were pretty wide apart, like 12 inches apart. And she said she just about passed out. She fell down. She collapsed, hit her chin on the way down on the counter of the sink. She's laying on the floor hyperventilating, and she's reaching over, tugging on her dad's pant leg as he's smoking a cigar and drinking a beer and playing cards. He wouldn't look at her. He wouldn't look at the window, but he kept repeating the phrase, "I don't see no goddamn monkey outside. I don't see no damn monkey out there." They finally heard it walk away. They figured that it put a hand on each side of the window of the truck and was looking in the sink at her. I mean, she saw it from like 12 inches away. And they finally heard the heavy breathing and the footsteps leave. And they looked out across from the front door and way across the property where the slash pile of trees was still burning. It was burning down into hot coals. They saw the silhouette of this thing right next to the fire, and it was silhouetted by the sunset. And they said it was swaying back and forth with its shoulders side by side, mesmerized by the fire. And they locked up the trailer and went to bed for the night. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff goes on in Washington State.
Yeah, a lot actually goes on in Washington State. And people generally are pretty open, a little bit more open than other places in the United States.
The thing that drives me nuts is the people who say there's no way they can exist. I mean, I know other teachers who will tell you in the same sentence, there's no freaking way that Sasquatch exists. But then they'll tell you about the Bigfoot or the flying saucer they saw hover over their house in the same breath, you know. So it irritates me to no end to see these professors. There are certain college professors that say that, well, there's no way they exist. You know, for some reason, man feels the need to see large, hairy creatures, you know, around the planet. And it kind of pisses me off, to tell you the truth. It's really insulting to my intelligence, you know. I went to college. I got 2 degrees. I'm not stupid. And then, you know, why would you make it up, you know? What do you possibly have to gain by telling people you saw Bigfoot? If anything, it could ruin your life. And, you know, I know that firsthand. I've been trying to get back in official wildlife work for 8 years now. It's like I've totally ruined my professional reputation now.
And that's a shame. I mean, and I've heard it before from police officers that come out or they break status quo and say, "Hey, look, I saw this, and it wasn't a man. It wasn't a bear. It wasn't, you know, it was something else. And here's what I saw," and they're ridiculed for it, and they're. You know, a lot of people lose their careers over coming out and talking about it. But, and I'm really sorry that it happened to you. And, you know, I wish that.
Well, you know, the thing that blows me away is the people you refer to as the flute players, you know, the habituators, and I'm going out and I'm leaving this for it, and they're leaving me gifts, and or they're psychically communicating with you. it's like I feel like these guys are delusional. And I mean, who knows, maybe the guys that think they're being, you know, communicated with, they're getting hit with infrasound or something, and it's making them go loony or something like that. But if they saw what I saw, and they saw what you saw from as close as we were, I mean, this thing was so gigantic, it could have picked me up by the neck like a three-year-old child with one hand, and the hand was so massive, I have no doubt it could have broke my neck without even trying. And if the thing turned around, it could have reached under our car and flipped us over with one arm. I mean, it was so muscular. And, you know, I haven't gone camping in 30 years because it makes me nervous. I know what's out there. You know, I have two daughters, and I refuse to take them camping in state forest land or national parks because I've heard all the Native American legends. All the Native American tribes on the West Coast, they say they're gigantic cannibals. They don't talk about them as the friendly forest brothers, you know, or gentle giant. So, yeah. You know, I like listening to your show because it kind of discusses the dark side of Bigfoot. And you hear David Pilates with his 411 missing. And, you know, I don't feel comfortable even going looking for tracks anymore by myself. You know, I feel like I should be packing a pretty heavy pistol. And these guys who think they're going to capture one or they're going to kill one, and especially the capture part, that's so unrealistic. If they saw what I saw, there's no freaking way you're going to haul one of those home. Even if you tranquilize it, you know, it'd probably take three or four or five guys to even try to get it in the back of a pickup. And then when the thing woke up, all hell's going to break loose and tear your truck apart, tear your house apart or whatever. And, you know, and then the guys that want to shoot one, I got to tell you, you got one shot. You miss and it knows that you shot it and you're within 30, 40 yards and you're dead meat. That's all there is to it. You wouldn't survive. If the thing turned on you, I mean, look at chimpanzees. We all know that they tend to go for fingers and face, anything that sticks out, genitals, fingers, thumbs, ears, nose. And little chimpanzees have been known to literally bite the face off of somebody. And look how much bigger these things are. These things dwarf gorillas. And we all know that gorillas can get up to 6 feet tall. You know, and to think that you would survive that. If you're watching some mountain monster show,
yeah,
with the hillbilly type guys, you know, lock and load, and it's so ridiculous and so crazy. If they literally saw, if Matt Moneymaker and the guys on Finding Bigfoot and Renee, you know, the skeptic, she's out there all by herself. That is so stupid. I'm sorry. If she ever saw one of those things as close as we've seen them, whether you're looking through a flare or whatever, it probably passed out from fear if they were that close and not in a car, you know.
When they're that big, I mean, when these things they're as big as what we've seen, it really is ridiculous to think you're going to tranquilize one and bring it in. I realize that, you know, not everyone wants to shoot one, and I get it. I mean, I completely understand why most people don't want to shoot something like that, but you're not going to tranquilize one of these things. It's just not going to happen. And you're right. Even if you do, what are you going to do? It's going to take a crane to put it in the back of your truck and get it out of there.
If you shot one, you know, well, you know, I thought about where would you shoot it. You know, obviously you're not going to try to shoot it in the back of the chest with all the heavy muscles. I mean, I've seen people shoot bull elk and they'll run another 200-300 yards and their heart's been blown away and they still run 200-300 yards. You know, if you shot in the chest or something, I don't think you'd drop it. If it was me and that was, depending on saving my life, I'd put one right through the eye or right through the ear, you know, go for a brain shot. But then you got the thing is, you know, the one that I saw, I don't know if it was in a clan. Maybe it was just a big rogue male. I know it was in perfect physical specimen, you know. It was like at the top of its A game. It was like the prime subject, you know, the major perfect Bigfoot. And so it could have had a clan, a harem of females like gorillas do. Or maybe it was a big male that was out looking for a mate.
It's interesting. One of your descriptions that you brought up is when you said it almost looked like it had no head. And as you and I were talking yesterday, down south, I remember someone had mentioned they called them no heads. And I was like, that's weird. Why do you call them no heads? And they said, well, from behind, it looks like they don't have a head because the shoulders are so big and there's a muscle on the back and they kind of lean their head forward. So when you see them from behind, they call them no heads. And I was like,
that's the deal. When I saw it getting ready to go into the trees, when I told you when I saw the ear that it was on the wrong spot on the head to be human, the head wasn't straight above the shoulders. It was leaning forward, just like a gorilla, you know. And so, you know, and I think they're gigantopithecus. You know, when the polar ice caps grew down across Canada, you know, the ocean levels went down. And when they did, they exposed a land bridge between Siberia and, you know, Alaska, the Bering land bridge. And that's where the Native Americans came over to this country. And that, I assume, is where the gigantic apes that they call gigantopithecus probably came over too. And, you know, I watched this one show that's called Giganto, the real King Kong.
Yeah.
And there's a college professor from back east who talks, he's a gigantopithecus expert. And he says, well, no, I don't believe these things are big feet. He says, there's no way that these are gigantopithecus, blah, 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 because they died out. Well, every time I see that show, I give the TV two fingers. I flip at the bird because it just pisses me off that somebody academic isn't open enough to the idea that why couldn't these things still be alive, you know? And I call them Naga. I call them North American great apes. You know, I used to work for a warehouse or tree company in the summer as a teacher on summer assignment. Down at the St. Helens Plantation, behind a fence with a security guard at one of their off-field offices, there is a chainsaw carving of what they call a brush ape. And it looks like Smokey the Bear. It's got jeans on, the suspenders, and a forester's hat. And I don't know if it's got a shovel in his hand, but it looks like an ape. I said, what the heck is that, a Bigfoot? And he goes, oh, that's a brush ape. And the guy goes laughing. The guy is laughing, and I said, what's a brush ape? He says, oh, that's slang for the choker setters. You know, the guys that they run around with the cables, and they're running across the trees and under the trees, and they're setting up the cables so they can drag the trees uphill with a crane. He says, we call those guys brush apes. I go, yeah, but why do you call them brush apes? You know, why aren't they mountain goats or something like that?
Right.
And so, well, I kind of wonder if some of the timber companies flat out know they exist and they're just trying to keep it quiet so they don't lose their timber contracts, you know?
Oh, yeah, they do. A lot of them do. You know, I've talked to guys at Weyerhaeuser, and they're told, their people are told not to come forward if they have an encounter, or not to go public with it, or they could lose their contract if they do. So they definitely know about it. I mean, those guys, they're out there all the time, and I've talked to some of them off the air that have come forward and said, hey, look, here's what I saw. Here's what we call them. The company's pretty well aware of these things, and we're told not to talk about it. But what's interesting, though, is one of the guys at Weyerhaeuser did tell me they do document their sightings, but it's a private thing that the company's doing. They actually document their own, within the company, the sightings. And I don't really know why they're doing that. I don't know
well,
if it's...
You know, believe it or not, they actually have a herd of wild horses up near Tenino on the warehouse or property that's not public knowledge. Well, I guess it is now. But they actually have a herd of wild Mustangs up there on forest land. And they don't want everybody harassing them. So, you know, the thing is, I wish the government and the Forest Service people would just come out and say, yeah, they exist. I really don't think it's going to destroy the tourist industry. If anything, more people are going to go out looking for the damn thing. But, you know, I think people that are out taking their families camping have a right to know what potentially is out there. I mean, who wants to have your kid disappear, for God's sake, or somebody, family member get killed or something like that because they run into one of these things?
Hey, MT, thanks so much for being on the show. I really do appreciate it. Thanks for coming forward. And I'm sorry again to hear about, you know, you losing your job for coming out and talking about it. And, you know, a lot of people probably wouldn't come forward and talk about it ever again. So I really do appreciate that, you know, you coming forward and talking about it.
Well, hey, thanks for having me on. And, you know, like I said, keep doing the good work. I listen to you every night. That's how I relax to go to sleep at night. And you got probably the best podcast I've ever heard. And it's actually nice to hear somebody talk about the dark side of Bigfoot. And you keep doing what you're doing and look forward to meeting you in person.
Thanks, man.
Some tone to go alone. The lights on, baby, you should know. Of you.